Good morning to y'all. Are we still in the book of Daniel? Wasn't that what I said last week? Book of Luke, chapter 6. Got this morning and two more Sundays, and we'll be through with chapter 6, looks like. So, we're going to be looking at verses 27 through 36. I've entitled the message this morning, Practicing the Golden Rule. I take it everyone has heard of the Golden Rule. Anybody not heard of the Golden Rule? You wouldn't admit it you had, would you? All right. Therese, tell him what the Golden Rule is. Okay, verses 27 through 36. And I will kind of read the text as we go through it rather than reading it all at one trip here. So begin reading. It says, "But I say to you who hear." I'll stop right there just a second. Who is it that hears? Everyone has ears, right? And not physically even, but we know what we're saying there. By nature, things are right. Everyone can hear. I don't think that's really what he's talking about here. He says other places Jesus does in the New Testament and the book of Revelation, I believe, primarily. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's a little different idea than just physically hearing. It's he who has a disposition to hear. He who is inclined to hear. That's really who he seems to be talking to. But I say to you who hear. What is it about a person that keeps them from hearing spiritually? First of all, they're dead in their sins, all of us are, and we are incapable of hearing the way that Jesus is talking about here, and in particularly Paul in the book of Romans. So there is a sense in which some people will not hear because they don't want to hear, and they will not hear because they cannot hear. Till God does something in their life. All right, I want to talk as well about the difference between positive and positive commands and negative commands. You remember as we went through the Ten Commandments, when we were going through the book of Exodus, there were two of the command. Most of the commandments were written in a negative sense. Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. But there are a couple that were written in a positive way. Somebody tell me what they were. Honor the mother and father. Remember the Sabbath day. Keep it holy. Those are the two. It's not anything in there about thou shalt not. It's honor your father and mother. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. All right, it is often harder to gauge our obedience, harder to gauge our obedience to a positive command than it is a negative one. For instance, thou shalt not kill. I'm not talking about on the surface. It's easy to know if we've broken that commandment. Thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not steal. How hard is it to know if you've broken that commandment to steal? All right, not too hard on the surface. I know that there are spiritual things going on there as well. But what about that commandment, honor your father and mother? If that commandment had been written like this, do not dishonor your parents, then that's easier to gauge than honor. Because all I have to do is think of one instance that I have not honored my parents and know that I've broken that command. But when you examine it as honor your father and mother, then you have to all of a sudden deal with this idea of What exactly does it mean to honor? And how much honor is enough honor to qualify as honor? Right? So you got that stuff there to mess with. So it's a little harder a lot of times to gauge your obedience to a positive command than it is a negative one. But also, negative commands are often easier to keep than positive ones. Now we're going to look at a phrase this morning where it says in verse 28, bless those who curse you. All right? What if that had said, do not curse those who curse you? You think you could handle that? I could handle that a lot easier than I can bless those who curse me. Right? One is telling you not to do something that I'm not perhaps not inclined to do anyway, you know, at least outwardly. But the other is a positive thing that I've got to take action to do something that I really don't want to do. Okay, it's a lot easier not to do something that I ought not to do, and then you're not too hard to not do it anyway, than it is to do something that I just desperately don't want to do. So there's this thing here of differences between the positive and the negatives. Now, number one on the outline is talking about parallel commands. We've talked about this before, and I don't know that these are intended to be parallel ideas, but I think they are. I haven't seen many people who talked about that in these verses. But parallel command, not commands necessarily, parallel thoughts. The book of Proverbs is full of them. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. The parallel thought is, lean not unto your own understanding. Two statements that are pretty much saying the same thing. I know we could nitpick and pick them apart and find some differences there, but the ideas are the same. Lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him. There's one thought. And He will guide your path. Now those do seem like totally different things, but they're pairs. And that's we see that in Proverbs. And I think we can see that here in these verses 27 through 30. So let's look at them. Verse 27, but I say to you who hear, we've talked about that, love your enemies. That's one statement. Do good to those who hate you. So there's our first one. Love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Now, how do you do that? Every one of these statements that I find, my flesh finds repulsive. All right? Every one of them, I immediately comes to my mind a situation where it seems like that just would not be the proper thing to do. All right? And we'll talk about some of those things. But here he says, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Well, first of all, I don't have any enemies. So y'all deal with this verse. Doesn't apply to me, right? All right, what's an enemy? When I think of the word enemy, I think of the North and South during the Civil War. And your enemy is either the North or the South, depending on where you're at, and you're opposed to one another, trying to do bodily harm to one another, or at least my enemy is trying to do that to me. That's what I think of when I think of enemy. Love your enemies. So maybe I'm having a little tougher time identifying my enemies. Who are your enemies? I've tried to come up with a thought, an idea that would help us identify the meaning or the idea behind that verses. And I think your enemy could be anybody who would do you harm or would not necessarily physical harm, but would cut you down to size or you, whatever you want to say, if they had the opportunity and could get away with it. All right, they don't like you and they just do all they can not to make that known. Perhaps they don't try very hard. But you know, if they had the chance, they would come at you in some way. Maybe tell tall tales about you, lie about you to other people. All right, I remember when I was in school, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, I wasn't a big kid. All right, I was, I never was taller than 5'7 and 9/16. That's the way I like to measure that. Probably more like 5'7 now. And at the end of my 11th grade year, I weighed 122 pounds. Okay, I was, I'm a little different nowadays. All right, married a good cook. That had something to do with it. So I wasn't big, but there's a kid in my class that was noticeably smaller than I was. And he was mean as a snake. He would hurt you just to get a jolly good laugh out of it. And but he was somehow, he was one of those kids that nobody ever beat his tail for doing it. You know, they just put up with him, and they might have scrubbed his head or whatever a time or two or something. But as far as anybody really making him quit do that, nobody did. You know, you just knew, oh, that's just Steve, and laugh it off. But I found myself, anytime he was around, I was keeping my eye on him. All right, I wanted to see where Steve is, because he just liable to jab me with a sharp pencil, or you know, just whatever. He just something to aggravate you, something to really, in a small way, hurt you. All right. So I would consider him in that regard as my enemy. But we're talking about, when we talk about love of your enemies, we're talking about somebody who is, they're not just trying to get a laugh. They're trying to harm you. Trying to destroy you. All right? Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. So how do you apply that? How do you do good? If you've got neighbors that they just don't like you, and you know they don't like you, and as far as you know you haven't done anything to them, how do you do good to those people? All right, I don't think that it's you bake them a sweet potato pie and you carry it over to them and say, just want to give you this, all right? I think you have to be careful not to give the appearance of buying friends, all right? You don't want to make them think he's just doing this because he doesn't want me to get him or, you know, whatever. Okay? I don't think that's the solution. I don't think that the answer to doing good is to just go out and, okay, how am I going to do good to them today? How am I going to do good to them tomorrow? You know, what am I going to do? All right, I don't think that's it. All right? What if there are people that I dislike more than others? All right? And what if one of those persons that I really dislike, and, you know, it'd be fine with me if they moved to South Africa. You know, it never came back. What if I going down the road and I'm at the point where I don't want to invest another 10 seconds of my life in them? And I'm going down the road and I see them have a tragic wreck and nobody is around and I am there. Now, here is my opportunity to avoid them, to let them lay there until the next person comes along. All right, is that what I should do? No. Should I stop and help them? If it takes spending $1,000 of my money, should I do it to save their life? I think so. I think there is a point where I have to give myself to help them. Now, that's not a great and righteous thing to do. It's just right. All right? Now, I'm sure there's more to loving your enemies and doing good to those who hate you than all of those things, but there's a starting place. The second one, bless those who curse you and pray for those who spitefully use you. Two phrases, bless those who curse you. So you've got someone who hates you, and even under their breath or perhaps, you know, audibly, they curse you. That's one phrase. The second one, pray for those who spitefully use you. Now that one, that last one is something we can do. It's not hard to figure out how to do that, to pray for those people who spitefully use you. You know, in the book of Matthew, in perhaps a slightly different context, Jesus makes a statement, lay up treasures for yourself in heaven. He goes and says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I'll tell you an application to that principle that I don't think Jesus, that was the context of Jesus' statement, but it is an applicable one. If there is someone that you really have a hard time liking, you have a really have a hard time communicating with, you just soon not be around them, pray for those, he says here, who spitefully use you. Okay? They don't have to necessarily use you, but pray for them. And here's what you will find. If you invest the treasure of your time praying for them, where your treasure is, you invest over and over and over again, if you invest your time in praying for them, you are investing some of your treasure. If you do that long enough, consistently enough, eventually your heart will follow. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. You may start out not loving that person very much at all, but there will come a point where you will care more for them than you previously did because you have invested yourself in them. Verse 29, to him who strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. There's one side of the equation. The other one is, and from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic also. Now this might be, let's suppose, for instance, that this is a judgment in court against you. Okay, that doesn't say that, but let's suppose it is. For someone who carries you to court and they take away your coat or your cloak or, you know, whatever it is they take away. And I'm in the wrong. I'm found guilty and I'm legitimately in the wrong. What should be my attitude in this court? All right? It should not be trying to see how little I can pay. My attitude should be to see it with all within my power to see that this person is legitimately satisfied that I have made restitution. All right? When you wrong someone and it costs them, and then you're supposed to make it right, and you fight like dogs to avoid paying any more than you have to, that doesn't look like you're sorry, does it? It looks like you're only doing what you have to do. Now, I know in our day, it's somewhat that's out of your hands, perhaps in some instances, because of your car's insured, you hit somebody, they're trying to sue you for $50 million, and it's not you that has a lot of control over that, it's your insurance company that are fighting another insurance company, fighting that person. So there are things that complicate that idea. But the idea is to be quick and eager and committed to making things right. Now, I imagine all these scenarios. What I look at or think of when I read this verse is, first of all, I'm glad I only have two cheeks, right? But what I think of is someone who is intentionally trying to take what I've got right in my face. And they are lying and stealing and cheating and whatever it is to do to get something from me that they don't deserve, that they shouldn't have. And what am I supposed to do? Just let them have it and turn the cheek and say, hey, take the rest of my money too, if you want it. Is that what this is talking about? I hope not. All right, I hope not. All right, I think there's more to that than this, than that right there. Years ago, there was a man. Y'all know Kathy Webb, who teaches the kids here. It's her daddy, Dale Ramsey. And he had a little country store right up the road, had it for years. And back then, a lot of these little country stores would have accounts. If I bought my gas there regularly, or if a farmer bought his feed there regularly, he could have an account and just pay it once a month rather than having to pay it every time he got it. So that was common. So, and Dale told me this story one time after he had sold the store and was out of business. He said, you know, one of the oddest things about people is, you know, he said, I had accounts at the store and people would owe me money and they would, you know, be going to pay at the end of the month. And there's always, you know, three or four or how many that are behind on their bill. And they don't want to pay, or they won't pay. And if I'm going to ask you a question. He said, when I would go and talk to them or mention it to them when they come in the store, you know what happens? You tell me. They would get mad. They owe him money, and they haven't paid. They're behind. And when he mentions it to them, they get mad at him. Is that not crazy? What reason do they have to be mad? None. None. He said, one day, this is what I started to tell you, this man came in, he owed him some money. And he asked him, you know, when can you pay your bill, get current on your bill? And he said, here's what he told me. He said, Dale, he said, you want to, he said, you're a Christian, aren't you? And he said, yes. He said, you want to do the Christian thing about this, don't you? They said, yes, I do. And the guy turned around and walked out and never paid him. As if the Christian thing to do was just to let him have it and not pay. All right? Every time I read this verse, I think of that. And I think of that my reading these things is I'm afraid if I try to do some of these things, that's exactly what happened to me. And honestly, I wouldn't like it. It would bother me for a while before I could just let that go and not want some satisfaction there. Verse 30, give to everyone who asks of you. Second phrase, and from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back. Y'all ever heard of somebody having a life verse? That's kind of a common thing that, you know, you're supposed to have a life verse. I don't know if y'all got it. How many of y'all have a life verse? Anybody? Okay. We're all kind of the same boat. Here's my life verse. It's 2 Thessalonians 3:10. And if any will not work, neither should he eat. Okay? That's my life verse. All right? That's probably, I may be the only person who has that as a life verse. Oh, I'm just kidding. But you read this, if a person who takes away your goods, don't ask them to give them back. Don't ask them to repay. All right? But yet we read over in Timothy, or 2 Thessalonians, if a person will not work, neither should he eat. So what if there's this person who won't work, they work harder at not working than they do if they would just work. All right? But they're not working, they have no intentions to work, and I could name you a dozen people that's like this. And they spend their life conjuring up ways to not work and to get something for nothing. This person, give to everyone who asks of you. Should I give to that person? If he asks me? From him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back again. Here's my second life verse. Ephesians 4:28. Now notice the parallel in this verse. Let him that stole, S-T-O-L-E, steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him who needs it. There's a lot of stuff in that verse. All right? Let's look at it. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather, so here's the opposite, compared to the contrast, but rather let him labor. This suggests to me, maybe it's suggested more than it ought to, but it suggests to me that a person who will not work necessarily almost every time becomes a thief. Now, they may not rob a bank, but if they get a government check, they're robbing. They're a thief. If they can work and won't work, instead of working, they take a check, they're a thief. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands that which is good. Now notice here's the going beyond. All right, this is something you might would find in our text this morning. That he may have to him who needs it. Part of the Christian's attitude toward working is not to pay their electric bill. Not only to pay their electric bill. But part of my attitude toward working ought to be that I might be able to accumulate something to help somebody who has a need. Now that's a novel idea. I don't know that I have thought of that very much in my life. I've thought about working. I'm committed to that concept of working. I'm committed to the concept of getting paid. I'm committed to the concept of paying my bills. I'm committed to the idea that there might be some extra. But at that point, a lot of my actions are to consume it on myself. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but Ted Gibson got a job. He had a retirement. He lived on his retirement from the railroad. He had a job at paper, Arkansas Democrat Gazette, or whatever it was, Little Rock. As far as I know, his commitment to himself, I don't know if it was to God or not, but what he decided to do was every dime that he made at that job went to Burma or somewhere else. And as far as I know, he kept that. All right? He did it enough that since Ted has died, our work in Burma will collapse unless God, you know, does something different. Because 99%, or nine, I should say 90% of what was give, we gave to Burma missions came from Ted. He worked to give. I'm a long way from that. So there's verse 27 through 30. Then we come to 31, which is a little different. And this is the golden rule. 31 says, "And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise." So there's the golden rule. You've heard it said different ways. The way I've always heard it was, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." All right? That's perhaps the most common rendering of it. And that's the idea. If you had to boil down my sermon this morning to one thing, perhaps that might be it. Do unto others as you have them do unto you. Now, we're going to look at the negative side of that. And it's common, and I've listed three guys here that wrote this idea, but in a different way. And there were more. I could have given you more, but here's three. Hillel, who was a Jewish rabbi, said it this way: "What is hateful to you, do not to another." Is that saying the same thing? Kinda, but not really. What is easier to do? Don't do something hateful to somebody that I would consider hateful, or do unto others as I would have them do unto me. The second one is the harder, the positive one, all right? Not doing something hateful, I refrain from that every once in a while, all right? So when somebody tells me, don't do something, if you don't want something hateful done to you, if you don't want people to steal from you, I don't want people to steal from me. I would consider that hateful. I don't want people to steal from me, so I don't steal from them, okay? I've kept the golden rule. No. No. What's the next one? What you hate to suffer, do not do to anyone else. A negative side of that, again, I could hang on to that. The third one, what you do not want done to yourself, do not do to others. Confucius had a bright remark there. But these are the negative. These things written in a negative way make them easy to comply. But that's not what Jesus said. He said it in the positive way. Do unto others. You're active. You're actively involved in acting out what? The way you want to be treated. The way I want people to treat me, I am to actively treat them in the same way. That's harder to do. Okay? But go on. Number three, a higher standard than your typical sinner. Now this is verses 32 through 34. All right, let's look at it. Verse 32. "But if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them." Now here he's appealing to us to be reasonable about this, just to think for a minute about this. If I only love people who love me, he asks the question, what credit is that to me? What's the answer? None. No credit there. If I only love people who love me, there's no credit to that. Verse 33, "And if you do good to those who do good to you, What credit is that to you? What's the answer? None. No credit. If I do good just to, only to those people who do good to me, there's nothing great and glorious about that. You shouldn't pat me on the back. You shouldn't say what a wonderful guy he is. Sinners do the same thing. Obviously, I'm a sinner too. But he's talking about people who have no intentions and no claim to follow Jesus Christ. They can do that. Verse 34, and if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? If someone comes to you wanting to borrow money, and the only person you will, you know, you say, okay, he's wanting to borrow money. What are you immediately thinking? Is he going to pay me back? Will he be able to pay me back? And if my decision to let him borrow money is dependent upon whether or not he will pay me back, Jesus asked the question, what credit is that to you? Anticipating the same answer, none. Now let's think just a minute. Let's suppose that I need some money. Whatever, something's happened, whatever it is, and I'm broke. Susan bought a bunch of lottery tickets. We'll say that. Maybe she won't listen to the sermon. And we're broke. And I come to you, and I say, I need to borrow some money. I need to borrow $1,000. And you say, okay, let's talk about this and think about it. You know, when could you pay me back? And you get out your pencil and the pad, and you say, how much money are you making? And what are your obligations, you know, to spend your money on? And you start asking me these questions. What's going to happen within me? I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to get mad. I'm going to get mad because you ask me these questions to see if I could legitimately pay you back. Is that right? All right, if your child comes to you, a grown child, wanting to borrow money, and you start quizzing a little bit, I guarantee you most of the time that's what's going to happen. Or your neighbor or your friend or whoever, people are going to get mad at you. Why is that? If I went to the bank, are they going to ask me those questions? Yes. Absolutely, they're going to ask me those questions. So why shouldn't I expect that out of somebody else, anybody else, that I go to borrow money from? Right. He says if you lend to those whom you hope to receive back. Now, you could read that as in just the principal. You receive your original loan back. The Bible doesn't condemn, contrary to what some people think, just interest. What the Bible condemns is excess usury. All right? Credit cards are an example of that. You have a credit card, and I can go to the bank and borrow money at whatever, 4%, 3%, and I could put stuff on a credit card and not pay it back and pay it off, and it's 15%, 25%, whatever it may be. All right? Now, that in itself may not be, you're not comparing apples to apples, perhaps, because they have a higher risk of default than the bank would. I understand that. When I was freshly married, Susan lived at Wynn for 9 months or something like that. I was working on a job over there. I worked with a bunch of guys who were about my age, and some of them a little older, maybe some a little younger. And they lived, you know what the expression means, somebody lives for Friday, right? They got their check, And three-fourths of them, by Monday, were absolutely broke. Okay? They'd blown it all. And Monday, about, they come to work, and they may have been had a hangover, whatever, but if they were there, they worked that morning about 12 o'clock, noon, they're hungry, just like I was hungry. I had a sandwich with me. They didn't have any lunch. They would, and there would be one or two of them that was not that way. They had some money. They had some of their money. And I've seen this a dozen times. This one guy said, "Hey, man, let me borrow $10. Pay you back Friday." And he said, "I'll let you borrow $10. You pay me back $20 Friday." That's pretty high interest rate, you know? I think we call that a service fee nowadays. All right? Is that wrong? In a way, no. Because the idiot guy spent all his money. Let him be hungry for a few days or a week or so, and maybe he won't spend it all next Friday. Okay, so I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong. But if the guy has a legitimate need, all right, if his child has a broke arm or whatever, and he needs to go to the doctor, and he has to have $10 or $50 or whatever, is it wrong for me to say, give him the $50 and expect him a week later to pay me back $100? Yes.
I mean, it's wrong.
That's wrong. If I'm letting him borrow the money because of an emergency, a health issue, legitimate need that's unexpected, then yes, it's wrong for me to think he ought to pay me back anything, actually. All right, so here's the thought. Look in verse 35. But love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. Now, that phrase right there is very hard to do. Hoping for nothing in your return. Let me tell you why it's hard. One reason why it's hard, because of the next phrase. And your reward will be great. God tells us, not just here, but other places, if you give, it will be given back to you, right? And yet, at the same time that we are aware that God promises us those rewards, great rewards, we are to give hoping for nothing in return. Is a great reward in heaven a return? Yes, it is. But somehow, I believe the Bible teaches us that we have to come to the place that we can give without considering and without doing it with that great reward in mind, without that affecting my decision. If I give to someone in need and I give because I'm expecting a reward in heaven, that's not giving. Let me give you example that happened to me just a week or two ago. I had my John Deere tractor. Okay, something cracked on it, and it needed fixing. And it needed fixing right now because I need the tractor. So I carry it to a guy, and I ask him if he can fix it. I don't ask him when he can fix it. I just ask him, can he fix it? I'm expecting to leave the tractor there, hopefully just for till tomorrow, through tomorrow, or whatever, you know. It'd be really nice if he could do it while I sit there and watch him and all this kind of stuff. But I'm not expecting that. He said, "Yeah, bring it on down." So I carry it down. He looks at it, and he says, "You know, leave it with me." And I said, and I did ask him, I said, "You know, when do you think you'll have it, a day or two or whatever?" He said, "Come back at 2 o'clock. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning." So that sounds awfully good to me. And I'd already begun to think in my mind, what's this going to cost? And I didn't know, but I figured it probably was going to be $100 or more. If it had been $200, I would have gladly paid it. I had to have the tractor. I might have thought, that's a little steep, but I had to have the tractor. I come back at 2 or 3 o'clock, and it's ready to go. I ask him how much I owed him. He said $40. And I'm sure I smiled. I gave him a $100 bill, and I said, keep it. Keep the rest of it. It's well worth that to me. Now, I'm not telling you that to pat myself on the back to think, make you think, boy, he's a big tipper or anything like that. And here's why. Why did I give him the $100 instead of $40? Because I was grateful that he got to it quick, that he was able to do it when I wanted it. Okay? So if I give just to somebody who can get it done in 3 or 4 hours, what credit is that to me? Maybe something. Okay? 2.5 times what he charged me is a little bit. But there's another reason I gave him $100, not $40. It's because I'm anticipating that the next time I go down there with a problem, he'll have the tendency to get to it pretty quick. Right? So what am I doing? I'm prepaying for a favor. Everybody follow that? All right. Now, that's not just totally bad and all that kind of stuff, but my motives were not quite as pure as I could lead you to think. Right? Hoping for nothing in return. Hoping for nothing in return. You know what that means? It means hoping for nothing in return. Nothing. That is hard to do. It is hard to do anything for anybody without some thought in your mind as, what am I going to get out of this? It's especially hard when you're about 12 years old or 18 years old. Tell you another story that doesn't make me look very good, but when I first got out of high school, I went to work with my dad, and they were finishing up a job, and it was me and my dad and this older man about 60 years old that ran the backhoe. He knew how to do everything on the job. He was kept to the end of the job just for that reason. Well, I come out there that summer after I got out of high school and worked that summer. They were just finishing up, kind of tying a bunch of loose ends, and it was hot. We're doing a lot of landscaping. I spread out a lot of topsoil around these. It was a sewage treatment plant, a lot of these concrete fixtures, you know, and buildings and pads and tanks and all this kind of stuff. Did a lot of that. And Lester was the guy's name. He worked right beside me almost every day, doing pretty much the same thing I did. Lester was making $6 an hour. I was making $3. His rake's the same size as my rake. Pretty soon I was hot and I was tired, and I got to thinking about how unfair this was. That we're doing the same thing. He's getting paid twice as much. And there was one building that had air conditioning in it. And before you know it, I'm spending a lot more time in that air conditioned building at the water cooler than I ought to have been. And by the unfortunate events, the turn of events, my dad noticed. And one day he came in there, and in front of the lab guy that was working, embarrassed me to no end. He said, you need to be outside working. And I had had enough. Okay? I said, why do I have to get $3 an hour and he gets $6? And we're doing the exact same thing. Now, here's not what he said. He could have told me a very legitimate reason why that was the case. He could have said, do you know how to run that backhoe? He could have said, do you know how to do this or do that that Lester knows how to do? And when it comes time to do that, he's going to be the one doing it, not you. He could have said that and had a very good point. But he didn't. He said this. You're not getting paid for what Lester does. Now get out there and go moving that dirt. You know, what he was saying was, it doesn't matter what Lester's making. Lester might be making $1,000 an hour, but you came here agreeing to get $3 an hour. It's immaterial what anybody else is making. If you're getting paid what you were told you would get paid, you have no gripe about anybody else. Is that right? It is. But it is hard to get that through your sinful head, whether it's you or whether it's me. To sum it all up, verse 36, be ye therefore merciful, just as your Father in heaven is merciful. Most of the things in these above things were not necessarily things where there were legitimate legal options that someone would have. All right? It is simply issues that come up in your life and in my life where we have the opportunity to demand what we think is right, or we can give mercy. Notice what he says, as your Father, God is also merciful. I heard a statement years ago that I want to share with you, but put in a different word. It was this what I heard was involving forgiveness, but the same principle applies with mercy. And this is not it, but I'm going to read this one on the outline first. Mercy is not required or legally binding. If someone is being merciful, it is not because they have to. Remember R.C.'s line? Someone says they're being merciful, you tell somebody you ought to be merciful, and he says you're not talking about mercy anymore. You're talking about duty. Mercy is not something that you ought to do. It's something that you may do, you choose to do, but it's not something that is owed to anyone, especially in our relation with God. Now, my relation with you is a different story. And here is the statement that I heard a long time ago. And it's in regard to forgiveness, but we'll apply it to mercy. It goes like this. Forgiveness for God presents God with the most profound problem. Do you look at God as having profound problems? No, I don't. And he didn't mean that, but here's the connection. Mercy, being forgiving for God, presents God with the most profound problem. But to man, to forgive is man's most obvious duty. What did he mean by that? Now, let's put the word mercy in there. Being merciful to God presents God with the most profound problem. Let's start right there. How is it that he uses these terms? Presents God with the most profound problem. Because the idea is this, because God is a just God. And how can God be just? How can God be just and things be exactly the way they ought to be and yet him show mercy to anyone? Or him forgive anybody? And there's where the satisfaction of God is met through the substitute, Jesus Christ. And we have all those things where all those things, God can be just, yet at the same time, merciful. Now, so there's God's profound problem. It really wasn't a problem for God, but that's the way it was. The other side of that, for me, being merciful or forgiving is my most obvious duty. Why is that? Because for me to be merciful to you, if I have any sense in my head, I ought to think someday I just might need some mercy myself. Someday I might need to be forgiven for something if I ever do something wrong, right? Someday I might need mercy. So reason screams at me to be merciful to you. You following that? Why in the world would I not be merciful knowing that I need it just the same as you? All right? These verses, and the more to come, are deeper than just those surface things. There are a lot of things required in there that you have to balance out between, you know, right and wrong and making other or letting other people be responsible and all those kinds of things. I know that. But my attitude and your attitude ought to be one of mercy. Be merciful. Let's pray.